And that's the kicking music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, everything is terrible. Well, at least that's what cultural critics very often say about books, television, culture in general, or in a recent debate, movies. We'll talk about whether everything really is worse, and if not, why everybody seems to think it is. Then we'll return to a topic we've touched on in the past, gifts. We'll try to help shake loose a couple of ideas from the corners of your mind using some ideas from the corners of ours. And then, as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I am the movies editor for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully happy to see all of you here, and we should note this is our last show that we are recording prior to our live show this weekend. You will barely be receiving this podcast before you have your last opportunity to decide to show up, but we will be doing a live show at 2 o'clock at NPR headquarters on December 15th. That's Saturday. That is the day after this podcast is posting.
And we're going to have buttons.
That's right. We have buttons to give away. They're very cute. They are very cute, and they will be...
They say Pop Culture Happy Hour on them, and there's one with an olive.
That's right.
What are we doing, charging $10 each? What are we doing there?
They will be yours for the taking. You can come up, and as long as nobody gets poked with any pins, it'll all be an entirely happy thing. Again, that is Saturday, December 15th at 2 o'clock. You can find more information at our Facebook page, facebook.com/PCHH. Okay, so let's get down to business about the fact that everything is worse. Now, what got us on this topic in the immediate sense is that Tony Scott in the New York Times had a piece in which he said, film culture isn't dead after all. Now, this was in response to a few other pieces that were floating around, one by Andrew O'Hare in Salon, and also David Denby's book, Do the Movies Have a Future? And here's what Scott said, part of it. The habit of issuing death notices for various cultural forms is a vivid example of sentiment and ideology masquerading as sober historical judgment. Film has been buried alive, sharing cemetery space with the novel, painting, serious theater, rock and roll, and all the other still vibrant artistic pursuits that are routinely mistaken for corpses or shambling brain-dead zombies.
Now, you just happened to pick the passage of that piece that I have had tattooed on my back as a way of paying tribute to how much I agree with it.
Yeah, yeah. It does seem like it's a little bit of a, it's a little bit of a recurring theme, you know.
Oh yeah, rock and roll is dead.
The theater is dead.
Oh yeah, criticism is dead. Right. The novel is dead, etc. He's so right.
Yeah,
I've found in general that people who, I don't want to cast aspersions on everyone who has ever said that something is in decline, but I always feel like that kind of absolute statement is pretty much always a reflection on the person making it.
And I think where their mind is at that moment.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And Scott, you call him Tony Scott. I know him pretty well. I call him A.O. Scott.
I only say that because other people say it, and I think initials sound stunt.
I've found that if you want to make me want to smack you, you have to correct people and say, excuse me, his name is Tony Scott.
I am trying to find a way that does not sound completely stilted. Now, just stop being a pain, Picky McGee, and talk about the thing.
Whatever his name, he made a good point. It's a very brief article, and yet he got some time to actually talk about why people might do this. And he was very humane about it. He basically was saying, our memory of something is colored by all the stuff that happened around it. And the example he gives is, you know, when you're watching a movie when you're a young man or young woman, you are sitting in that theater, you're feeling good because you're young and healthy, and you're wondering if you're going to have sex that evening. And as you watch it later on in life, you're sitting there on the couch, your spouse is falling asleep, and you're having herbal tea.
And you know you won't be.
Exactly. And what that does is it colors your impression. And I thought that was a really smart thing, because it is human nature to say the things that were around when I was a kid were better than the things that there are now.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Well, and I think one thing to keep in mind in general is, I mean, let's say that the four of us are sitting around this table, and we all think that modern culture is entirely bankrupt. We do not control the fact that there are new generations coming up who will pine for it because they'll have been young. You know, I pine for things, you know, from the late 1970s, which were a cesspool of garbage. But I pined for it because I was 7 years old.
Right.
Had my entire life in front of me.
There has been some very interesting pushback in other forums and in the comments on that article on the Times website, where people have made some good points about the way conversations about culture are fragmenting and becoming less informed and becoming less thoughtful.
But I mean, I think like anything, it depends on where you look. Yes, absolutely. Everything is more fragmented. I think it is absolutely true that we have fewer collective cultural experiences that sort of everybody can gather around the water cooler and talk about. But that doesn't mean the culture itself is bad.
There's also a difference between, I mean, look, sometimes when people say movies are dead, rock and roll is dead, books are dead. Mm-hmm. They're talking about movies are bad now. TV is bad now, right? If you look at some of the stuff that went around about the sitcom being dead, it never meant there weren't any on.
Right.
It meant they were bad. But there is a different thing that happens, and this was really the theme of the O'Hare piece in Salon, which was called Is Movie Culture Dead? And what he was really talking about was sort of a longing, like it really wasn't the films themselves. It was, I took this passage because you really have to hear it. It says, when the New York Film Festival was launched in 1963, the films of the French New Wave were the hottest things on roller skates, and the Mount Rushmore great men of post-war art cinema, Bergman, Truffaut, Fellini, Kurosawa, were at or near their career peaks. Cocktail party debate among the chattering classes often revolved around existentially inflected black and white works like La Ventura, Last Year at Marienbad, or violent, generationally defined American films like Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde, along with the contentious reviews published by Pauline Kael, Andrew Saris, and numerous others. Those who hadn't seen such films or hadn't gotten them felt not so subtly left out. I'm not claiming, by the way, that the unquestioned elitism that underlay that kind of film culture was necessarily constructive. He kind of is. But in fact, I would say that the New York-based media and intelligentsia had an outsized cultural influence that simply isn't possible today. But the point of those conversations was never supposed to be discussing the films in pure or formal terms. It was all about what they meant, what they told us about the human soul or the emptiness of contemporary existence or the evils of capitalism, or at least about the importance of getting laid. A reliable constant. Okay, here's my problem. According to what I have been able to find out, he graduated from college in 1984. And from pictures I have seen, it does not look like he graduated from college at, say, 60.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my question is, how do you know what cocktail parties were like in 1963?
Yeah. And what is the likelihood that in 1963 they're? I mean, that's a little bit what the movie Midnight in Paris is about. For as massively flawed as that movie is, it makes a great point that I guarantee you, in 1963 they were like, oh, things were so much better around the time.
In the 40s,
in the 30s. Yeah.
And the thing that's amazing to me about this argument, and the other reference it made me think of is Rosie O'Donnell in Sleepless in Seattle. Saying to Meg Ryan, you don't want to be in love. You want to be in love in a movie. And what this made me think of was, you don't really want to talk about films. You want to talk about films on Mad Men, or you want to talk about films in a book.
He wants to talk about films as an act of performance in front of someone he wants to impress.
Well, it's like you want to talk about films in a literary short story. From 1968 about how 1963 was, or something approximately like that. It sounds so fake to me.
And as if those people at that time didn't have doubt in their mind.
Well, of course.
And I always feel like that's a part of it. It's like things were purer then. People just had ideas and talked
about it. And nobody wondered about the collapse of civilization. And nobody thought that everything was falling apart. Oh, except for everyone who thought that everything was falling apart because of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Okay. And flower children in Vietnam.
May I bust out a needlessly overwrought metaphor that will likely shut down conversation completely?
Please do.
As is my wont.
Oh, do go on.
The human body, settle in, get some Skittles, get a drink.
Okay.
The human body's first line of defense against carcinogens are collectively called the phase 1 and phase 2 enzymes. They work in concert. The phase 1 enzymes take potential carcinogens that enter the body and activate them, make them bigger, stickier, more dangerous, so that the phase 2 enzymes can come along, find them, and usher them out of the body. When this system is working in perfect concert, carcinogens pass through without doing any damage whatsoever. Sometimes, however, the system gets out of whack. The phase 2 enzymes activate a carcinogen, make it a real carcinogen, and it can do damage and open the door to the cancer process before phase 2 enzymes usher them out.
So is this why I have to eat blueberries?
This is why you have to eat blueberries and broccoli and all that kind of other stuff. However, the metaphor I'm talking about here is that today's culture is all phase one enzymes. It's all novelty is the engine that drives the cultural conversation. So there's an entire industry about hyping and promoting the new. And now, in a perfect world, the phase two enzymes would not be a bunch of middle-class white guys. But that's what we're stuck with, people. Mm-hmm. And this pushback, all I'm saying is that that pushback from these dudes, and all the dudes listed in the A.O. Scott piece are middle-aged white dudes, that pushback, that is a useful conversation to have. Because I'm not talking about the nutrients that enter the body. I'm not talking about the antioxidant phytochemicals that enter the
body. Holy moly.
I've thought about this.
I was going to say.
I am talking about those things that get more power, get more toxicity than they deserve. Am I calling LMFAO a cancer on the body of the culture? No. I'm saying they're an activated carcinogen.
You know, it's really, you know, it's really interesting. I find Glenn sort of inherently interesting. I tend to just find him interesting when he talks. And yet that is bumping up against the fact that I have no idea what he's talking
about.
Yeah, that's
what I said. Yeah. Usually you use a metaphor to make something clearer. That's the easy one. I've decided I know better. But you get what I'm saying. I'm saying,
of course, you're saying the critics, and actually I heard a sort of somewhat more concise variation on this this notion earlier today via Twitter, as a matter of fact. Critics are our friends because they tell us what's wrong with ourselves.
Okay.
My thing about this, I guess, I mean, when it's nostalgia, I tend to be very, at least, sympathetic to it, right? If I'm saying pop music isn't as good as it was in 1982, okay, which is totally true, by the way. No, I'm just kidding. If I say that, it may very well be because that's my memory. It's in my childhood. And I feel like there's a difference between that and this sort of longing for something that you wish you could have been a part of that you weren't. Like, that's people now who are nostalgic
for something they didn't experience.
You know what I mean? Like, people who are 25 now who romanticize the 1940s. People who are, you know, 30 now who want to go live in Downton Abbey. You know what I mean? That's a different kind of thing, which to me, those just become completely false comparisons. Those become comparisons that I have very little sympathy for and very little patience with, I guess.
Well, and what's interesting,
in terms of the, you know, everything is terrible now because it's not like
it was in an imagined past.
Well, I think it was on Badass Digest that there was a piece that ran about the O'Hare piece in Salon that basically said it's this kind of Woody Allen vision of New York chattering classes, and frankly, who cares? It's this kind of like, who thinks that's cool?
Right. When you advance an argument and make it sound like chattering classes is a good thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, part of it is railing against the democratization of conversation.
Exactly.
You know, this notion, and, you know, it's no mistake that a lot of this chatter is originating in New York. You know, this sense that, oh, people who shouldn't be talking about this are talking about this, and how terrible is that? And you know what? Screw those people.
Right.
But at the same time, Linda, you were saying you don't truck with people who are pining for an imagined past. I actually, in a sense, sort of feel like when you're somebody who is saying that everything current is bad and everything that you experienced was good, I actually feel like in a way that's sadder. Because I feel like when you think that everything around you is bad, it's because a piece of you has sort of atrophied and died.
Right. If you look at the vast landscape of pop culture and you can't find anything to be happy about.
Exactly.
Right. Well, and there's a certain amount of it, too. I mean, some of it is just flat out misinformed or poorly informed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's actually pretty much announced that it's poorly informed.
Right.
These are the people who come and say, I haven't watched television since 1995, and I haven't missed anything.
Right. Right.
And it's like, well, how would you even have any idea? And it becomes like, it's almost like thinking everything is bad is an end in itself. And there's a certain avoidance of even knowing what's going on. And to me, I don't have a problem at all. I've written before about the phenomenon of you can't take in everything. You're going to die ignorant of the vast majority of the culture that happens in your lifetime, that happened before your lifetime. You're going to, as I've put it before, miss almost everything.
Yep.
Statistically speaking, there is no shame in that. There's no whatever unless
it is a mathematical impossibility.
Right. Unless you're trying to generalize about everything that is and ever was and and try to sort of come up with some kind of grand vision of when things were good and when things were not good. Your mind is so small. Your perspective is so small.
Yeah, but that's not true of the four dudes who are highlighted in the Scott piece. They are informed. They are deep thinkers. Now, their reaction is disappointing, but I still think it's important to have that conversation. And even if your reaction to their argument is flat-out rejection, you still react to it.
I don't know. My reaction to David Denby is usually pfft.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, well, I feel like I you haven't could read that book. I
feel like, and I haven't read that.
See?
I haven't read that.
See? Well,
I've read Snark. Give me a break. But you can chalk up that guy's general persona to things are bad and I am sad.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm sorry. Like, I
but I'm also awesome.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
Well, here's a question. Just putting it out there, devil's advocate, just asking the question. Are things worse?
Not to me. I mean, it depends on what you're looking at. Like, there are sort of boom times and bust times in different kinds of things. I was just thinking this weekend, it's not a very good time, for example, if your thing is romantic comedies.
Right.
It's kind of a...
have Gerard Butler in them.
But even as I say that, I know that there are a lot out there and I just don't know about them. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about big ones, if you're talking about, like, big ones kind of delivered to your door, big marketing pushes, whatever... It's not a great time for that kind of movie, where it is kind of a great time for, like, dark thrillers.
Mm-hmm. Or, like, if you like military
your spy thrillers yeah. military right. thrillers, if that's your thing, it's more of a boom time. And I get that. So it really depends on what you're talking about. It's definitely a big time for certain kinds of very dark and violent television, but it's a limited, you know, the view is limited in other kinds of television.
And it is not the golden age of the sitcom.
Right. There's always been schlock, and what's changed, I think, is the tenor of the reaction to schlock, because certainly before the blockbuster, there wasn't this monetary resentment on the part of critics. You know, they would slam a Cannonball Run 2, or they would slam, you know...
Wrongfully.
Right, exactly, or a cheesy Western, but it wouldn't be this, how dare this exist, which is right. what you're hearing now, yeah. for example, superhero films. Now, superhero films are going to churn through just like everything else does. There'll be a boom and a bust, and we'll move on to something else. And when that happens, then there'll be this reaction, this how dare this be the popular thing, which is just when your argument is predicated upon how dare people like this.
Yeah.
But isn't that a product of the mouthpiece as much as anything, that in order to be heard above the din of social media and everybody sort of having a megaphone at the same time, you have a lot of that criticism is naturally going to be more shrill.
You know, I value the kind of critical conversation that exists and is, in fact, much more immediate because of social media.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on Twitter and you follow a bunch of film critics, you can frequently be part of really interesting, vibrant back and forth between writers that you like about movies that, you know, are in your theater or whatever. Mm-hmm. I do worry that the kind of, like, everything is terrible starts to sound to people a little bit like that conversation is kind of disappearing up its own nose. You know what I mean? And I worry about that, especially, like, this is really a time of year when I worry a lot about the nature of that conversation and the fact that because all the critics groups are, you know, want to get their awards out first before everyone else gets their awards out, you now have special screenings of movies that aren't out yet and won't be out for a long time. So what you're having is, like, the most intense arguments back and forth about the merits of these films take place before anyone else, any normal right. people, get a chance to see them. So it kind of feels like, well, they're over there having an argument about Zero Dark Thirty, which I can't see yet.
You know, even there, I mean, think about how much the pre-release conception changes once a movie comes out. If you remember, there was a movie critic who got, like, death threats for not liking Dark Knight Rises.
Mm-hmm.
And once that movie came out and people saw what a gigantic pant load it is.
Steven likes it a little less than some people
differ.
Did. Steven didn't like it as much as some of you.
But, I mean, there were a lot more.
The hive mind shifts exactly.
once these things come out.
Well, and sometimes the hive mind is one thing in the opening, like, week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And then it very quickly becomes more mixed. That's the story of Inception. I mean, mm-hmm. when Inception first came out, there was this whole, like, how dare you be the first person to give a negative review of Inception.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was David Edelstein.
I think he was.
But then, you know, by the time that movie had been out for a couple weeks, there are people who are like, I really loved it. And there are other people who are like, meh. You know what I mean? Like, I thought it was a little, you know, it's a little gunsy, you know? That conversation can shift so quickly that I really worry about that whole critical debate disappearing into kind of a black hole of who caresiness. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the stuff about, you know, it's dead, it's not dead, like, who, other than film critics, who cares about that? Like, who is following this? Like, please tell me whether films are dead so I know what I'm doing this weekend. Like, no one does that. No, like, nobody. I mean, if you can make it a really compelling argument, or if you can make it a really interesting kind of call for a different kind of movie, or a very specific complaint, but when you're all just sitting around talking about TV is good, TV is bad, which is better, films or television, who cares except you? Like, I don't know, maybe I'm just grumpy because it's award season. It's very possible.
Well, I mean, okay, I'm still trying to drill down the notion of, is there any argument to be made that culture is worse than it used to be?
Like, how would we know? Like, you can never escape your own perspective. You can't be someone other than yourself. And one of the things I think is very weird about critics attempting to develop an objective viewpoint, either of a specific film or a film in general or a film right now, is that when you aspire to objectivity, you are denying your fundamental humanity and your fundamental uniqueness, which are the only reasons for anyone to read your criticism.
To be a critic, yes.
So when you say, well, you know, this is the objectively true film, and only someone acting in bad faith could possibly be saying it's not, which, think. Think about what that means.
Mostly I'm just whacking the hornet's nest with a broom handle. I don't know if you guys have noticed.
Anyone acting in, if you say, and I will get off this, I swear to God. If you say anyone acting in good faith would immediately know that A is a good movie and B is a bad movie, what you are saying is all you need is good faith and you know everything I know.
Right.
Because otherwise...
It's the Aaron Sorkin approach.
It's not... I didn't say that. It's not unique to me. It's not my perspective. It's not specific to my humanity or my taste or anything else. Anyone acting in good faith immediately knows what are the good movies and what are the bad movies.
Right.
And that's what we're all here to talk about, in which case, go home, because who cares?
Yeah, why even keep reading?
I act in good faith, so if I go to the movies, I'll know everything you know. Because the only basis for disagreement is for people to act in bad faith. I'm sorry, I'm going to be quiet.
Drives you crazy.
It does.
I think you have to remember, too, that even one single critic's opinion of a particular work can change over time.
It's true.
Right.
Absolutely.
Things
true.
Are less new, things are less surprising, or you're older and grumpier.
Right.
I mean, I had a fairly visceral reaction to a play I saw this past weekend, and because it was a play that was designed to be interactive and audience involving and social media-fied, we were asked to tweet our reactions. And so as the evening goes along, I'm getting increasingly grumpy on Twitter.
And to the point
where people are starting to talk back to me and ask me why I'm tweeting during the play.
They're just asking you, what was your deal?
But, you know, as of today, I have to sit down and write the slightly more formal review. And in that review, I am, of course, going to take into context the thought that it will strike other kinds of people differently.
Yeah.
If you're the Stephen Thompson in the room and you like sort of getting up and wiggling your behind in front of everyone.
The rube.
Well,
wow.
The extrovert. The guy who...
When have I ever...
Come to the live show.
If you're the guy who likes to get up and, you know, sort of...
Be paid attention to.
Paid attention to, you know...
That's fair.
To bounce your way through a K-pop song at your local tavern's karaoke night,
yes,
then you're going to have a blast. You're going to have a blast at this play.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what we're touching on here, and now we're sort of talking about more criticism in general, but I mean, for me, from my perspective, it is best of season. It is write your year-end top 10 list. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling I could wind up Linda Holmes talking about top 10
lists. Just don't.
But you know,
I'm already wound.
It's completely unmistakable when you are putting together a top 10 list that it's just uniquely informed by your own experiences. The tone of the albums that I picked as my favorite albums of the year are unmistakably tied to circumstances in my life in ways that, while if you like my taste in music, you'll like these records, but you're not sharing my experiences. I mean, it could not possibly be a less objective process, even though there is a certain amount of everybody loves the Frank Ocean record, everybody loves this record, everybody loves that record. You know, when you look at these top 10 lists, you can only look at them through the lens of one person.
Sure, but that doesn't mean that you're not trying to create an argument that you're basing on facts, that you're basing on things besides opinion. As I said before, when I'm writing a book review, I am trying to argue to find some metric that says this is objectively good or this is objectively poor and here's why. The here's why is where it all comes down to. If there's no here's why, if it's just opinion, then yeah, you're,
but,
I completely
agree.
but your way of contextualizing that is going to be unique to you, is, right. is what I'm saying. And if you try to take that part out and say, no part of my analysis of this is unique to me, then who cares?
No, I get that.
You know what I mean?
But also at the same time, I mean, I write about music. I tend to write from a standpoint of writing. And this is I can feel you cringe in advance of what I'm about to say. A lot of what I write about when I write about music is feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not objective. Yeah. It's not, oh, I really love the way these four bars captured blah, blah, well, blah.
But you are writing about sentiment versus sentimentality. If something is reaching for sentiment, trying to make you feel something, and it's cynical or it's manufactured mawkish, or if it's mawkish, then you call that out.
Right.
You're arguing for skill. You're arguing for effectiveness. Here's why this works. Here's why this doesn't.
But when you're talking about sort of to kind of drive this back in the direction of what we were originally talking about, which is the kind of, is everything worse? No matter what you come up with that you say is good, the problem is it remains so influenced by your own perspective.
Right.
That's what I was trying to get at when I was saying, I think trying to say, is it worse or better right now? Compared to what? You know, as Stephen was saying, my current experiences inform everything that I like and don't like. And despite the fact I agree with what you're saying, I mean, today I finished my top 10 TV list for the year, which I tried to do without overthinking it because I was afraid that if I sat around and thought about it, it was going to start to be me thinking about what do I want my top 10 list to look like.
Right.
So I tried to sort of go a little bit off of gut once I tried to kind of do a mental review and used some of my post history and stuff like that to look at what had I written about, things like that, so I don't forget anything. But when you look at my list, you will see certain things that I think objectively critics have agreed have quality, right? Breaking Bad's on there, mm-hmm. Homeland's on there, Mad Men's on there. But you will also see Happy Endings is on my list.
Mm-hmm. Bunheads.
Bunheads is on my list. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Late Night with Jimmy Fallon is on my list.
Sure.
You would look at that list and say, that has to be Linda's list.
Right.
And that's what I wanted. I was afraid. I did not want to create a list that was going to look like everybody else's list because I do not trust that. Sure. I do not believe that everybody really likes the same 10 things.
So I think what we've come down to here is that we are in agreement that broad sweeping statements about the decline of civilization and culture are sort of boneheaded on their face.
They're suspect.
Yeah.
But yes, I would love to hear what people have to say about this. Mm-hmm, I don't know about the rest of you, but I think everybody should come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us that everything is worse now, or possibly better, or just the same. All right, well, now that we've talked about whether everything is worse, we will talk about something that hopefully is not going to be worse, which is the giving of gifts.
Absolutely.
The giving and receiving. But we thought that this time we would focus a little bit on the giving and talk a little bit about gift ideas in the, you know, in the pop culture arena, presumably. Glenn Weldon, how do you feel about gifts?
Oh, I'm pro. I come down firmly pro.
Yeah.
It's a controversial assertion, but I'm going to stand behind it.
Right.
We're going to talk at some point about the permanence of pop culture and, you know, whither the Blu-ray, whither the DVD,
sure.
yeah.
when you can store things in the cloud nowadays. That said, Blu-rays and DVDs are made for Christmas and Hanukkah.
True.
They are
that's
made
true.
To give, here is a thing I'm giving you. Here's a hard copy thing. And this year there happened to be some really great movies that came out on Blu-ray. Little Shop of Horrors, the director's cut. For the first time, you can actually see the ending that Frank Oz intended, the dark original one from the play, Trey Graham, in full color. They Live, the John Carpenter film starring Roddy Piper, a very funny film. You can see the whole 6-minute fight scene in 1080p, so look for that. And several films were just recently added to the Criterion Collection, which should have been on that list for a long time, including Harold and Maude, Being John Malkovich, and finally, Brazil. Brazil. You can also get the complete set of The Dick Van Dyke Show, all 158 episodes for just $300. So you can see, you know, Laura Petrie in her capri pants and high def.
$300.
High def, black and white.
$300 worth of Mary Tyler Moore pants.
Yeah. It's a great show.
It's a great show.
But $300, I don't know.
You have neglected to mention the 50th anniversary Blu-ray edition of Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes, of course. And you can get several different versions of that, including some which are a little bit more grandiose than others.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Blu-ray, man. It's like if you like DVDs but wish the packages were smaller and more expensive.
Yeah.
I don't get the appeal of Blu-ray, but that's
a... Until you have watched one on a gorgeous, high-end, flat-screen TV and appreciate the blacks.
I have. It's not
appreciate the blacks, my man.
Oh, you're a music guy. What do you know?
Trey Graham, gift guide.
Well, I am, because I am that guy, I am going to give my nephews the His Dark Materials books.
Yay.
The Golden Compass and its sequels. It's two sequels. They are by Philip Pullman and were written as sort of a response to the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe books. And they're just dazzlingly imagined, and they will teach my oldest nephew all about despair and death and corruption. And I'm very excited to introduce him to the adult world in this way. If you would like something a little less dramatic, or maybe more dramatic, I would say just give somebody you love or give yourself some theater tickets, or tickets to a performance of something live, whether it's, you know, highbrow or lowbrow. Get out of the house and do that, because I'm totally going to be doing that a lot this season.
Burlesque.
Burlesque, in fact.
I don't know. I was thinking burlesque.
Absolutely.
Stephen Thompson, you're a smart gift guy.
Am I a smart gift guy?
I think you are.
Well, my stuffed animals are buying me a Roku box. That's the first...
I actually think you would really enjoy a Roku box.
I am buying myself a Roku box. That is my Christmas present from myself to myself.
So you're saying I can't get you a Roku box for Christmas?
You cannot get me a Roku box because I
That's
just...
That's actually my plan.
That's incredibly thoughtful, Linda Holmes. Yes,
I'm totally going to get you a Roku box.
It kind of somewhat falls into the category of New Year's resolutions, which is probably another thing that we're going to talk about, but certainly giving the gift of a portal into a world of of entertainment that you can explore. And I am mired in 2002 or whatever the pre-Roku verse.
You are mired in the pre-DVR verse.
Mm-hmm. I am mired in the pre-DVR.
I would get that first.
Well, we shall see. But anyway, a few weeks ago, we were talking about holiday albums.
We were.
And a bunch of people have written in and said, what was the album that Stephen recommended? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I forgot. He said it and I forgot. It's, he said it and no one could understand him.
Which is always, it was a little marble mouth.
Always
apparently.
A great sign in radio.
People seem to have thought you said it was by Love.
It is not. It is by a band called Low.
L-O-W. Low.
The album is called simply Christmas.
Yes.
Not simply Christmas, but Christmas. It is a gorgeous half hour of perfect, perfect holiday music. I've heard.
If you like your holiday music dark, I mean, we should point
it's
out.
It's a little dark. It's a little dark,
very
but it's.
Sad holiday music, with the exception of maybe the first.
The first cut is definitely cut. The least.
First cut's upbeat, but after that,
dour.
It's pretty much Christmas is. Death time.
Well, every year there's always a token album that I subtitle A Very Dour Christmas. A few years ago, it was the Amy Mann, One More Drifter in the Snow. This year, it's Tracy Thorn, Tinsel and Lights. Great records. Solid records. But they're dour. Anyway, Low, Christmas, please. As far as kids go, I hesitate to spoil, you know, since my kids do listen to this show, I hesitate to spoil what I am getting for them. I'm sure my son would recommend the series of books called Warriors, which is about clans of fighting cats.
I was going to say, it's cats.
If you have small children who are obsessed with cats, I have seen several different children of several different demographics obsess over these books. There's about 25 of them. My son just burned through them all. My daughter's best friend is burning through
them all. So now I have to sell them all on eBay.
So now my copies are all out on loan to my daughter's best friend. But Warriors, if you're my kids are 8 and 11. If your kids are young and into cats, I recommend the Warriors books. I think I've talked about this on the show before, but the complete George of the Jungle is on DVD. Mm-hmm. Anytime you can buy complete series that maybe you loved as a kid that you can share with your own children. There are increasingly inexpensive Atari 2600 simulators that you can plug and play in your television if you would like to share with your children the love of playing the dot.
Yeah.
Pitfall.
Pitfall. Yeah. I have loved...
Oh, I loved Pitfall.
Pitfall's awesome. It's always fun. If nothing else, you can feel incredibly old because your kids will laugh at you.
Pixels the size of a half dollar.
Especially on a large TV, that dot in Adventure is the size of your head. And finally, I mean, certainly anything that comes with your time and anything that comes with your ability to bond. This will be giving something away to my kids in case they do listen to the show, but I will be buying my kids new blankets, in part because it will be sort of tied into an opportunity to bundle up on the couch and watch TV together.
Is this where I tell you that I'm giving you a gift certificate for hugs? I'm just kidding. I'm not doing that. Okay, so I'm going to give you a fat pocketbook option, a skinny pocketbook option, and a no pocketbook option. Okay. Fat pocketbook option. Now, Glenn mentioned $300 Laura Petrie, right? Mm-hmm. I did recently get the opportunity to preview a list price $300, but you will actually pay more like $200. Alfred Hitchcock Blu-ray collection called the Masterpiece Collection. The films are Saboteur, Shadow of a Doubt, Rope, Rear Window, The Trouble with Harry, The Man Who Knew Too Much, Vertigo, North by Northwest, Psycho, The Birds, Marnie, Torn Curtain, Topaz, Frenzy, and Family Plot. I started with Rear Window, as I would, and enjoyed it a great deal. Most of the features have been on previous sets, but the fact that they're on Blu-ray is in many cases new. They are lovely. I've not watched all of them, but the ones that I have seen are lovely versions. They look great. If you've only ever seen these films on TV, on kind of old prints, they are a lot of fun to see. And this set, although certainly doesn't have everything, certainly there are pieces missing, because what tends to happen is one company that released a bunch of stuff has a set, but it doesn't have the ones that came from the other company. So you have different, you know, different stuff from different times. But this is the splurge gift for a person who kind of likes the old.
The tricky thing with these box sets is always the Hitchcock buff has some of them.
It's true. It's true. So this would be kind of like a, you know, you got to have exactly the right person.
Yeah.
But it is a really nice set. So when I was thinking about good gifts, that definitely occurred to me. The skinny pocketbook option, I would offer you two things. One would be movie night. As Trey talked about with theater tickets, it's even cheaper to do a couple of movie tickets, especially if you're in a position to say, and I'll go with you, and we'll have movie night, and you can buy, you know, you can buy a gift card that will buy, you know, what are increasingly expensive movie tickets. And that will theoretically get you out of the house, because I think a lot of people, there's so much stuff now on Amazon and Netflix and all this stuff that you don't really have to go out as much. And sometimes I think giving people a little nudge, let's go to the theater, see something big, I think that's a nice idea. Or there is always, I will mention one more time, Alan Sepinwall's book, The Revolution Was Televised. Very good for a pop culture aficionado, and recently given a positive review in the New York Times.
Yay!
So, a rave in the New York Times.
Absolutely true. So that would be the skinny pocketbook option. And then the no pocketbook option is something I would call...
coupon for free hugs.
Coupon for free hugs. The thumb drive of happiness. Now, there are thumb drives floating around all over the universe, and people use them much less than they used to in the age of Dropbox and Google Drive and your iCloud, whatever you Mac people like. But but the thumb drive still exists. In fact, people give them away for free all the time. I have way more than I'll ever be able to use because, you know, they're given out as swag and junk. But they still work. And what I am thinking is, there's so much like video now and free stuff and great writing and good songs. If you found like a good theme, like how to relax or how to rev up, and you put just, even if it was just a simple document on the thumb drive that had, I mean, you could put some music on there, you could put some video on there, but if you're low tech, just make it like a simple document with a bunch of links so that the person just gives you a physical manifestation of something that is just an opportunity, something you have curated thoughtfully.
Yeah.
It is your power of curation, and it costs nothing as long as you can find a thumb drive lying around, which you probably can.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea, Linda Holmes.
So that would be my no pocketbook option. And in terms of kids, it is an oldie but a goodie. I have mentioned it before, but there is a 30th anniversary Schoolhouse Rock collection, which came out in 2010. I personally believe every child deserves to be exposed to Schoolhouse Rock. Not enough of them are. All kids should listen to Schoolhouse Rock. So that would be my kids' option.
Yep. Co-signed, 100%.
Yep.
Yeah. So that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I have a podcast recommendation. Wait.
You don't say.
It is not a comedy podcast recommendation. It is a fiction podcast recommendation. It's called Getting On with James Urbaniak. His voice will be familiar to anyone who has seen The Venture Brothers. He's the voice of Dr. Venture. But if you've seen Homeland, he's also Larry the Polygraph Guy.
That's right.
And he, of course, played Robert Crumb in American Splendor, the film American Splendor. He reads a series of monologues written by a variety of playwrights and screenwriters, including Anne Washburn, Bree Williams, Andy Bragan, and Coleman Huff. And these monologues are doing something similar to what Alan Bennett's Talking Heads do, which is that the narrator is telling you one version of events, and gradually you start to fill in what's actually going on around that person. There is a definite sinister quality to some of them. There is something that's very
intimate. There is some of them are kind of disquieting, but all of them are really, really smartly produced, well-written, and incredibly well-performed. So look for that. Getting On with James Urbaniak. He's only on his fourth episode, and I think it's a monthly podcast, so it's a good time to jump on.
You are a connoisseur of the podcast.
Indeed. I love that one.
I like it. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
All right. Well, we've talked about him and heaped some praise on him already, but in addition to the piece that inspired our first segment, there is in the Hollywood issue of the New York Times Magazine an essay by Tony Scott on the year of heroin worship. Uh-huh. This is not the controlled substance. This is strong women in the movies. And it is hard to avoid sounding like a tool when you describe something as magisterial, but it really kind of is. Mm-hmm. It is clearly a piece he took a lot of time with, put a lot of mental energy into making connections and drawing out themes. He looks both at the strong women who have starred in the movies from this year and last that we would say passed the Bechdel test, mm-hmm. in which he says passed the Bechdel test. But he also points back to the golden era of great woman's pictures, the mm-hmm. term that they used to use for these big melodramas and romances and, you know, quality movies that made stars of people like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Ingrid Bergman. And there's a nice meditation on the difference between that and what that artifact used to be and what we now call, in rather a demeaning way, the chick flick. Mm-hmm. So it's a meditation on these performances, but also on how this sort of changing Hollywood notion of the female audience's value is. Mm-hmm. It's just a good piece, and I like him.
Wonderful.
And the package comes with a whole lot of crazy multimedia stuff online. So if you read it in the print magazine, then go look at what they've done with these little short films.
All right. And if you are a little bit Trey mentioned the Bechdel test. If you're a little bit confused by the mention of the Bechdel test, I'll just say we will link to some more information about it. It's essentially a test that was formulated to judge whether a movie allows its female characters sort of lives of their own and contact with other women that's not just about dating and things like that. So we'll link to some more information about it, but that's what that is. It is called the Bechdel test, Bechdel, and that's what we are talking about. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Said the Gramophone is a music blog that I like, or run by a guy named Sean Michaels. And he, at the end of every year, puts together, like many people do, his list of, you know, sort of X number of favorite songs, albums, whatever. Well, he does a 100-song list and makes available for a limited time an MP3 bundle that you can download through one of those god-awful services that, mm-hmm. you know, you can't even tell where the download button is. Mm-hmm. Curatorially, really interesting guy with really interesting sensibilities. He's the guy who got me into Sharon Van Etten because he had picked one of her songs as his favorite song of the year a few years ago, and that got me into her. So somebody that I trust, find interesting, certainly don't agree with all his selections, but it's a wonderful way to get lost in 6 hours and 45 minutes of music. That mm-hmm. just came out this week, and I'm swimming in it. Of course, I just finished my year-end mix, and now I've got to leave slots open in case I discover something new. The other thing is, we're recording this on Monday. Last night's Simpsons, mm-hmm. when I heard the description of it, sounded like I was being Hugh Jackrolled. Mm-hmm. that people were saying, oh, it's got Patton Oswalt on it, it's got Carrie Brownstein and Fred Armisen, it has the Decemberists, but also has a joke about The Onion mm-hmm. and the AV Club, mm-hmm. of which I am the founding editor. It sounded like the sort of thing that people would make up, and then in place of an episode of The Simpsons with all those things, it would be a 30-minute trailer for Les Miserables. Mm-hmm. But
which, just so you know, people, is a thing you can still do.
I'm mm-hmm. sure it is. And people were, what's funny is people were tweeting me, like, you have to turn on 60 Minutes, you have to turn on 60 Minutes. Apparently, at the same time, they were interviewing Hugh Jackman, and he was singing, What Have I Done? Like, opposite this episode of The Simpsons with Carrie Brownstein, the AV Club, and basically everything I've ever
As
liked.
I told you, I told you that I had heard that the opening involved the whole family coming into the living room and sitting on your kids.
It's really all it was missing. And what's making me happiest about it, I mean, certainly the AV Club thing just blew my mind, but what's making me happiest about it is the episode was incredibly funny.
It was good, wasn't it?
It was really good. Yeah. Now, I have not paid super close attention to The Simpsons for, mm-hmm. for quite some time, and it's not because I have rejected it. It's because I've decided I'd like to watch it later when the stakes are lower.
Yeah.
It is no longer appointment television where I cannot possibly wait to see it. I'd rather gorge on it, and if there's a weak one, it just goes by.
Right.
If it's consistently this good, and I actually don't know if it's consistently this good, I would make appointments with it. It was incredibly encouraging, and it's very interesting when shows are on long enough that they're not hot topics anymore,
right,
but are still good.
And it can actually clear out a space and sort of play in that space in an interesting way. The some of the dings it got today was they've done this plot before.
Sure.
That is not an argument to make for a show
for that's 450
that's
like, episodes.
That is not a valid argument. You have to move on. What they're doing is different. What they're doing is more of the moment. And
yeah,
really,
you know, Homer says dough in this episode.
I know, right?
But it's a very, very, very funny episode, and I'm just delighted that The Simpsons is still in my life.
Glad to hear it. All right, what is making me happy this week? First of all, the live show coming up.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that. Looking forward to it. Hope that you will all come out. And the other thing is the IKEA monkey.
Oh, my God. I was hoping somebody was going to mention
the
that.
The best news story of the year. I do not care what else anybody tries to put up. This is the news story of the year. There was a small monkey discovered walking around the parking lot of an IKEA in Toronto wearing a shearling coat.
That was the detail that sold it.
Yep.
Now, that's what put it over the top.
My argument is, that's true, but my argument is what makes this a great story is that every element is funny.
Right.
The monkey is the funniest animal. Mm-hmm. IKEA is the funniest store.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Shearling coats are the funniest coat. And Toronto is the funniest city for this to happen.
Right.
In.
Okay.
Right.
So it is a perfect collection of comedic elements. And there were a bunch of photos. Now, this was a story that really got legs from the existence of, you know, everybody tweeting photos.
Right.
Because what happened is basically that people saw the monkey.
Seeing as how it was in an IKEA lot.
Started tweeting pictures of the monkey. And then you start to get the news organizations saying, I'm sorry, can we use your picture of the monkey?
Right.
And they would say, sure. And so then you started getting news articles, and then they started to spread. And then it became Twitter's responsibility to make every available joke. One of my friends had tweeted, have you seen my monkey? He's wearing a coat. He likes meatballs. and something. I can't
press
remember
board
what
furniture.
Yeah,
whatever,
and yeah. There was a whole bunch of stuff that was like just people talking about, like, that it was the greatest headline in history, that the person who wrote the headline, monkey found in IKEA parking lot wearing coat, you could just retire on that headline. Mm-hmm. There were a bunch of wonderful sort of, it just became this wonderful, completely funny, happy. Now, look, you're not supposed to keep exotic animals.
Right.
Right.
I understand
and let
that.
And let us note, for the record, that one of the things we're happy about this is that it had a happy outcome.
The monkey is fine.
He's being taken
he's
to
being
a shelter.
He's being taken care of. The monkey is fine.
Hey, the monkey's famous.
The monkey is fine. But if you don't like jokes with monkeys and Allen wrenches, then you and I cannot be friends. I love the IKEA monkey. He immediately had at least 2 parody Twitter accounts.
Yep.
It's all happy. I love the pictures of the monkey. If you haven't seen the pictures of the monkey in the shearling coat, you just absolutely cannot possibly understand how great it was. Yep. That's the happiest. That's the happiest I've been in years.
Then you spent the rest of the day staring into the middle distance.
So that's what's making me happy this week. Monkey in a coat at an IKEA in Toronto. Because it's hilarious. Anyway, that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with me, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. We hope to see as many of you as possible at the live show.
Yay!
In DC. More details at facebook.com/PCHH. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.